offices and Black Ajah about it. Well, she still believed that this was in fact Egwene. Imitating a woman's features was easy, but prying out her memories was another story. Swan made certain to look into the woman's eyes. There had been talk of what had happened at the Black Tower. Mirel had spoken of it, of events shared by her new warders. Something dark. They said you could tell. Swan would see the change in Egwene if it had happened to her. Wouldn't she? If we can't tell, Swan thought, then we're already doomed. She would have to trust the Amyrlin as she had so many times before. Gather the Aes Sedai, Egwene said. Commander Bryn, you have your orders. We hold at this river unless the losses become so absolutely unbearable that... She trailed off. How long have those been there? Swan looked up at the Rakan scouts passing overhead. All morning. You have his letter. Bloody man, Egwene said. The Dragon Reborn's message, delivered by Min Farshaw, had been brief. The Shanshan fight the shadow. He'd sent Min to them, for reasons the woman wouldn't quite state. Bryn had given her tasks immediately. She was working for the Supply Masters as a clerk. Do you trust the Dragon Reborn's word regarding the Shanshan, Mother? Saeron asked. I don't know, Egwene said. Form up our battle lines anyway, but keep an eye on those things up there, in case they attack.
As Rand entered the cavern, something changed in the air. The Dark One only now sensed his arrival, and was surprised by it. The dagger had done its job. Rand led the way, Nynaeve at his left, Moiraine at his right. The cavern led downward, and climbing down it lost them all of the elevation they'd gained. The passage was familiar to him, from another's memory, from another age. It was as if the cavern were swallowing them, forcing them down toward the fires below. The cavern's ceiling, jagged with fang-like stalactites, seemed to lower as they walked, inching down with each step. It didn't move, and the cavern didn't gradually narrow. It just changed. Tall one moment, shorter the next. The cavern was a set of jaws slowly tightening on its prey. Rand's head brushed the tip of a stalactite, and Nynaeve crouched down, looking upward and cursing softly. No, Rand said, stopping. I will not come to you on my knees, Shaitan. The cavern rumbled. The cavern's dark reaches seemed to press inward, pushing against Rand. He stood motionless. It was as if he were a stuck gear, and the rest of the machine strained to keep turning the hands on the clock. He held firm. The rocks trembled, then retreated. Rand stepped forward and released a breath as the pressure lessened. This thing he had begun could not be stopped now. Slowing strained both him and the Dark One. His adversary was caught up in this inevitability as much as he was. The Dark One didn't exist within the pattern, but the pattern still affected him. Behind Rand, where he had stopped, lay a small pool of blood. I will need to be quick about this, he thought. I can't bleed to death until the battle is finished. The ground trembled again. That's right, Rand whispered. I'm coming for you. I am not a sheep being led to the slaughter, Shaitan. Today I'm the hunter. The trembling of the ground seemed almost like laughter. Horrible laughter. Rand ignored Moiraine's worried look as she walked beside him. Down they went. An odd sensation came to mind. One of the women was in trouble. Was it Elaine? Avienda? He could not tell. The warping of this place affected the bond. He was moving through time differently than they, and he lost his sense of where they were. He could only feel that one was in pain. Rand growled, walking faster. If the Dark One had hurt them, Shouldn't it be growing lighter in here? They had to rely on the glow of Kalendor as he pulled Sayadin through it. Where are the fires? Rand asked, voice echoing. The molten stone at the bottom of the path.
The fires have been consumed, Luz Theron, a voice said from the shadows ahead.
Rand stopped, then stepped forward. Kalendor thrust out to illuminate a figure on one knee at the edge of the light, head bowed, sword held before him, tip resting against the ground. Beyond the figure was nothing. A blackness.
Rand, Moraine said, hand on his arm. The Dark One wells up against his bonds. Do not touch that blackness.
The figure stood and turned. Moradin's now familiar face reflecting Kalendor's glow. Beside him on the ground lay a husk. Rand could explain it no other way. It was like the shells some insects leave behind when they grow. Only it was in the shape of a man. A man with no eyes. One of the Murdral? Moradin looked to the husk, following Rand's gaze.
A vessel my master needed no longer, Moradin said.
Saw floated in the whites of his eyes, bouncing, shaking, moving with crazed vigor.
It gave birth to what is behind me.
There is nothing behind you.
Moradin raised his sword before his face in a salute.
Exactly.
Those eyes were nearly completely black. Rand waved for Moraine and Nynaeve to stay a few steps back as he approached.
You demand a duel? Here? Now?
Aelon, you know what I do is inevitable. Slowing me has no purpose.
No purpose, Luz Theron, Moradin laughed. If I weaken you even slightly, will my master's task not be that much easier? No. I think I shall indeed stand in your way. And if I win, what then? Your victory is not assured. It never has been.
I win again, Luz Theron.
You could step aside, Rand said, raising Kalendor, the glow of its light shifting off Moradin's black steel sword.
If my victory is not assured, neither is your fall. Let me pass. For once, make the choice you know you should.
Moradin laughed.
Now? Now you beg me to return to the light? I have been promised oblivion. Finally, nothing. A destruction of my entire being. An end. You will not steal that from me, Luz Theron. By my grave, you will not.
Moradin came forward swinging. Lan executed cherry petal kisses the pond. Not an easy task from horseback, as it was not a form designed for the saddle. His sword slashed into the neck of a trollic, just an inch into the creature's skin. That was enough to make fetid blood blossom in a spray. The bull-faced creature dropped its catchpole, reaching up to hold its neck and let out a gurgling half-scream, half-groan. Lan danced Mandar backward as a second trollic came for his side. He cut its arm off as he spun. The trollic stumbled from the blow, and Andir ran it through from behind. Andir moved his horse up beside Mandarb. Over the din of battle, Lan could hear his friend panting. How long had they been fighting here at the battle's front? Lan's arms felt like lead on his shoulders. It hadn't been this bad during the blood snow.
Lan! Andir shouted. They keep coming!
Lan nodded, then moved Mandar back again as a pair of trollocs shoved their way through corpses to attack. These two had catchpoles as well. That wasn't uncommon for trollocs. They realized that men on foot were far less dangerous to them than men on horseback. Still, it made Lan wonder if they were trying to capture him. He and Andir let the trollocs come through and attack as two members of the High Guard rode in from the side to distract their attention. The trollocs came for Lan, and he lurched forward, swinging and cutting in half the shaft of each of their catchpoles. The beasts didn't stop, reaching brutish fingers to try to pull him down.
Lan could smell their putrid breath as he rammed his sword into the throat of one. How slowly his muscles moved. Andir had better be in position. Andir's horse came in with a sudden gallop, slamming its armored flank into the second Trolloc, knocking it to the side. It stumbled, and the two mounted guardsmen butchered it with long-handled axes. Those men were both bloodied, as was Andir, as was Lan himself. He only vaguely remembered taking that thigh wound. He was growing so tired. He wasn't in any condition to fight.
"We pull back," he announced reluctantly. "Let someone else take the point for now."
Lan and his men were leading the heavy cavalry at the tip of the fight, pressing against the Trollocs in a triangular formation to shear through, and pushing them to the sides for the flanking attacks to crush. The others nodded, and he could sense their relief as he pulled himself and his 50-something high guards back. They retreated, and a group of Shinarans moved in to fill the point. Lan cleaned his sword, then sheathed it. Lightning rumbled above. Yes, those clouds did seem lower today, like a hand slowly pressing down upon the men as they died. Lightning bolts cracked the air nearby, one after another. Lan turned Mandarb sharply. There had been a lot of lightning today, but those had been too close together. He smelled smoke on the air.
"Dreadlords?"
Andir asked. Lan nodded, eyes searching for the attackers. All he could see was the lines of men fighting, the swarming mass of Trollocs driving forward in waves. He needed higher ground. Lan gestured at one of the hills and heeled Mandarb toward it. Members of the rear guard watched him pass, giving a raised hand and a Daishan. Their armor was stained with blood. The reserves had been rotated to the front, then back again during the day. Mandarb plodded up the hill. Lan patted the horse, then dismounted and trudged beside the stallion. At the top, he stopped to survey the battle. Borderlander armies made spike-like indentations of silver and color in the Trolloc Sea.
So many.
The Dreadlords had come out on their large platform again, the mechanism pulled by dozens of Trollocs as it rolled across the field. They needed height to see where to direct their attacks. Lan set his jaw, watching a series of lightning bolts strike the Kandori, hurling bodies into the air and opening a gap in their lines. Lan's own channelers struck back, hurling lightning and fire at the advancing Trollocs to keep them from pouring through the hole in the Borderlander line. That would work for only so long. He had far fewer Aes Sedai and Ashaman than the Shadow had Dreadlords.
"Light," said Prince Kaisel, riding up next to him.
"Daishan, if they rip enough holes in our lines..."
"Reserves are coming. There," Andir said, pointing.
He was still mounted, and Lan had to step forward to look around him to see what he was indicating. A group of Shinaran riders was making for the lines upon which the lightning bolts were falling.
"There too,"
Kaisel said, pointing to the east. A group of Arathalan were making for the same place. The two forces became entangled as they both rushed to close the gap at the same time. Lightning began to strike down from the sky, raining on the Dreadlord's platform. Good. Narishma and Maris had been told to watch for the Dreadlords and try to kill them. Perhaps it would distract the enemy. Lan focused on something else. Why had two groups of reserves been sent to plug that same hole? Either unit would have been large enough for the job. With so many, they had interfered with one another. A mistake? He climbed into Mandarb's saddle, reluctant to make the horse work again so soon. He would check on this error. Within the wolf dream, Perrin and Gaul stopped on a ridge overlooking a valley with a mountain at the end of it. Above the mountain, the black clouds spun in a terrible vortex that didn't quite touch the mountain's tip. The winds ravaged the valley, and Perrin was forced to create a pocket of stillness around himself and Gaul, deflecting debris. Down below, they caught quick fragments of an enormous battle. Aiel, Trollocs, and men in armor appeared in the wolf dream for moments as if out of twisting smoke and dust, swung weapons, disintegrated in mid-blow. Thousands of them. Many wolves were here in the dream all around. They waited for something they could not explain to Perrin.
They had a name for Rand, Shadow Killer. Perhaps they were here to witness what he would do.
Baron? Gaul asked.
He's here, finally,
Baron said softly.
He has entered the Pit of Doom.
Rand was going to need Perrin at some point during this fight. Unfortunately, Perrin couldn't just stand here. There was work to be done. Gaul and he had, with help from the wolves, found Grendel near Kyrian. She had spoken to some people in their dreams. Dark friends among the armies, perhaps?
She was peeking at Bashir's dreams before that, Perrin thought. Or so Lanfear claimed.
He didn't trust her for a moment. Anyway, he'd found Grendel earlier today, and had been planning to strike when suddenly she had vanished. He knew how to track someone in the wolf dream when they shifted, and he had followed her here to Thakandar. Her scent vanished sharply in the middle of the valley below. She'd traveled back into the real world. Perrin wasn't certain how much time had passed in the wolf dream. He and Gaul still had food, but it felt as if it had been days and days. Lanfear said that the closer Perrin came to Rand, the more time would distort. He could probably test that statement at least.
"He is here, young bull."
The sending came, sudden and urgent, from a wolf named Sunrise here in the valley.
"Slayer comes among us. Hurry!"
Perrin growled, grabbed Gaul by the shoulder without a word, and shifted them. They appeared on the rocky path leading to a gaping hole in the rock above, the passage down to the Pit of Doom itself. A wolf lay nearby, arrow in its side smelling of death. Others howled in the near distance. The horrible wind whipped at him. Perrin lowered his head and charged into it, Gaul at his side.
"Inside, young bull," a wolf sent. "Inside the mouth of darkness."
Not daring to think about what he was doing, Perrin burst into a long, narrow chamber filled with jagged rocks projecting from the floor and ceiling. Ahead, something bright sent pulsing waves through the space. Perrin raised a hand against the light, vaguely catching sight of shapes at the end of the chamber. Two men, locked in battle. Two women, as if frozen. And just a few feet from Perrin, Slayer, drawing his bow to his cheek. Perrin roared, hammer in his hand, and shifted himself between Slayer and Rand. He slapped the arrow from the air with his hammer a split second after it was loosed. Slayer's eyes widened, and he vanished. Perrin shifted to Gaul, grabbing the man by the arm, then shifted back to where Slayer had been and caught the scent of his location.
"Be wary,"
Perrin said, then shifted them after the man. They dropped into the middle of a group of people. They were Aiel, but instead of wearing normal shufa, they had strange red veils. The shift hadn't taken Perrin and Gaul far. This was a village of some sort, close enough for the peak of Sheol Ghul to be visible in the distance. The red veils attacked. Perrin wasn't particularly surprised to find Aiel on the side of the shadow. There were dark friends among all peoples. But why identify themselves with the color of their veils? Perrin swung his hammer in a wide circle, keeping a group of them at bay, then shifted behind them, crushing the head of one from behind. Gaul became a blur of spears and brown clothing, dodging around red veils, stabbing, then vanishing, and then appearing and stabbing again. Yes, he'd learned quickly, more quickly than these red veils apparently had, but they failed to keep up with him. Perrin smashed another in the kneecap, then searched for Slayer.
There.
He stood on a hillock above, watching. Perrin glanced at Gaul, who, between jumps, gave him a quick nod. There were 8 red veils left, but... The earth underneath Gaul's feet began to heave, exploding upward as Gaul jumped. Perrin managed to protect his friend, creating a steel plate beneath him to deflect the blast, but it was a close thing. Gaul landed shakily, and Perrin was forced to shift to him and attack the red veil coming at him from behind.
"Take care," Perrin yelled at Gaul. "At least one of these fellows can channel."
Light.
As if Aiel fighting for the shadow weren't enough. Channeling Aiel. Channeling Aiel men.
Light.
As Perrin swung at another, Slayer arrived, a sword in one hand and a long hunting knife in the other. The type a man would use to skin his prey.
Growling, Perrin threw himself into the fight, and the two began a strange dance, one attacking the other, who vanished to appear nearby before attacking also. They spun about like that, one shifting, then the other, each trying for an edge. Perrin just missed crushing Slayer with a blow, then nearly caught Steel in his gut. Gaul was proving very useful. Perrin would have had a terrible time trying to stand alone against both Slayer and the Red Veils. Unfortunately, Gaul could do little but distract his foes, and was having a very difficult time managing that. As a column of fire from one of the Red Veils nearly took him, Perrin made his decision. He shifted over to Gaul, and almost took a spear through the shoulder. Perrin turned the spear to cloth, and it bent on his skin. Gaul started, seeing Perrin, then opened his mouth. Perrin didn't give him a chance to speak. He grabbed his friend by the arm, then shifted them away. They vanished just as flames welled up around them. They reappeared before the entrance to the Pit of Doom. Perrin's cloak was smoldering. Gaul was bleeding from the thigh. When had that happened?
"Are you there?"
Perrin sent out, urgent. Dozens upon dozens of wolves replied.
"We are here, young bull. Do you lead us, young bull? The last hunt. Watch for Moon Hunter, young bull. She stalks you like a lion in the high grass." "I need you,"
Perrin sent to the wolves.
"Slayer is here. Will you fight him, and the men with him for me?" "It is the last hunt,"
one sent back, as many others agreed to help him. They appeared on the slopes of Sheogul. Perrin could smell their wariness. They did not like this place. It was not a place wolves came, not in the waking world nor in the dream. Slayer came for him. Either he realized Perrin would be guarding this place, or he intended to finish his attack on Rand. Either way, Perrin caught sight of him standing on the ridge up above, looking down into the valley, a dark figure with a bow and a black cloak whipping in the tempest's winds. Beneath him, that battle still raged in dust and shadow. Thousands upon thousands of people dying, killing, struggling in the real world, only phantoms reaching this place. Perrin gripped his hammer.
"Come try me," he whispered. "You'll find me a different foe this time."
Slayer raised his bow, then loosed. The arrow split, becoming 4, then 16, then a hail of shafts, shooting toward Perrin. Perrin growled and attacked the column of air that Slayer had created to stop the wind. It dissolved, and the raging gale caught the arrows, spinning them about. Slayer appeared in front of Perrin, brandishing knife and sword. Perrin leaped at him as the Red Veils appeared nearby. The wolves and Gaul dealt with them. This time Perrin could focus on his enemy. He swung with a roar, slapping Slayer's weapon away, then aiming for his head. Slayer danced back and created stone arms that burst from the ground, throwing chips and shards of rock to seize Perrin. Perrin concentrated and they burst, tumbling back to the ground. He caught the sharp scent of Slayer's surprise.
"You're here in the flesh," Slayer hissed.
Perrin jumped for him, shifting in mid-leap to reach the man more quickly. Slayer blocked with a shield that appeared on his arm. Mahalanir left a large dent in the front as it was deflected. Slayer vanished and appeared 5 strides back on the rim of the pathway leading up to the cavern.
"I'm so very glad you came hunting me, wolf pup. I was forbidden from seeking you, but now you are here. I skinned the sire, now the pup."
Perrin launched himself at Slayer in a blurring leap like those he used to bound from hilltop to hilltop. He crashed into the man, throwing them both off the ledge in front of the opening to the Pit of Doom, sending them tumbling dozens of feet toward the ground. Perrin's hammer was at his belt. He didn't remember putting it there, but he didn't want to hit this man with the hammer. He wanted to feel Slayer as he slammed a fist into the man's face. The punch connected as they fell, but Slayer's face was suddenly hard as stone. In that moment, the fight became not one of flesh against flesh, but will against will. As they fell together, Perrin imagined Slayer's skin becoming soft, giving beneath his punch, the bones brittle and cracking. Slayer, in response, imagined his skin as stone. The result was that Slayer's cheek became hard as rock, but Perrin cracked it anyway. They hit the ground and rolled apart.
When Slayer stood, his right cheek looked like that of a statue hit with a hammer, small cracks moving out over the skin. Blood began to trickle through those cracks, and Slayer opened his eyes in shock. He raised a hand to his cheek, feeling the blood. The skin became flesh again, and stitches appeared, as if sewn by a master surgeon. One could not heal oneself in the wolf dream. Slayer sneered at Perrin, then lunged. The two of them danced back and forth, surrounded by churning dust that formed the faces and bodies of people struggling for their lives in another place, another world. Perrin crashed through a pair of them, dust streaming from Mahalainir as he swung. Slayer skidded back, creating a wind to blow him out of the way, then struck forward too quickly. Perrin became a wolf without a thought, Slayer's sword passing over his head. Young Bull leaped into Slayer, slamming him backward through an impression of two Aiel fighting one another. Those exploded into sand and dust. Others formed to the sides, then blew away. The howling tempest was a roar in Young Bull's ears, and the dust ground into his skin and eyes. He rolled across Slayer, then lunged for his throat.
"How sweet it will be to taste this two-legs blood in my mouth."
Slayer shifted away. Young Bull became Perrin, with hammer at the ready, crouching on the plain of fragmentary, fighting, changing people.
"Careful," he thought to himself. "You are a wolf, but more a man."
With a start, he realized that some of those impressions weren't completely human. He saw a couple that were distinctly snake-like in appearance, though they faded quickly.
"Does this place reflect other worlds?" he wondered, not certain what else to make of the phantoms.
Slayer came at him again, teeth clenched. Perrin's hammer grew hot. He realized that some of those impressions weren't completely human. He saw a couple that were distinctly snake-like in appearance, though they faded quickly.
"Does this place reflect other worlds?" he wondered, not certain what else to make of the phantoms.
Slayer came at him again, teeth clenched. Perrin's hammer grew hot in his fingers, and his leg throbbed where he'd been hit and then healed during his last fight with Slayer. He roared, letting Slayer's sword close, letting it graze him on the cheek, as he crashed his own weapon into the man's side. Slayer vanished. Perrin followed through with the swing and, for a moment, assumed he'd beaten the man. But no, his hammer had barely connected before Slayer disappeared. The man had been ready, waiting to shift. Perrin felt blood moving through the hair of his beard toward his chin. That graze had cut a gash across his cheek, much in the same way as he'd landed that blow on Slayer's face. He sniffed at the air, turning about, trying to catch the scent of Slayer's location.
Where had he gone?
There was nothing. Slayer hadn't shifted to another place in the wolf dream. He knew that Perrin could follow him. Instead, he must have jumped back into the waking world. Perrin howled, realizing he'd lost his prey. The wolf railed against this, a failed hunt, and it was a struggle for Perrin to bring himself back under control. It was a scent that brought him back to it. Burning fur. It was accompanied by howls of pain. Perrin shifted himself back to the top of the pathway. Wolves lay burned and dying amid the corpses of red veils. Two of the men were still up, back to back, and incongruously they'd lowered their veils. They had teeth filed to points and were smiling, almost with madness as they channeled, burning wolf after wolf to char. Gaul had been forced to take shelter beside a rock, his clothing smoldering. He smelled of pain. The two smiling channelers didn't seem to care that their companions were bleeding to death on the ground around them. Perrin walked toward them. One raised a hand and released a jet of fire. Perrin turned it to smoke, then parted that by walking directly into it, the gray-black smoke eddying against him, then streaming off. The other Aiel man also channeled, trying to rip the earth up beneath Perrin. Perrin knew that earth would not break, that it would resist the weaves. So it did. Perrin could not see the weaves, but he knew that the earth, suddenly far more solid, refused to budge as ordered. The first Aiel reached for his spear with a growl, but Perrin grabbed him by the neck. He wanted so badly to crush this man's throat. He had lost Slayer again, and wolves were dead because of these two. He held himself back. Slayer. Slayer deserved worse than death for what he had done.
He didn't know about these men, and he wasn't certain if killing them here would kill them forever without rebirth. It seemed to him that everyone, including creatures like these, should have another chance. The red bill in his hand struggled, trying with weaves of air to envelop Perrin.
"You are an idiot," Perrin said softly.
Then he looked to the other one.
"You too."
Both blinked, then looked at him with eyes that grew slack. One started drooling. Perrin shook his head. Slayer hadn't trained them at all. Even Gaul, after only... how long had it been? Anyway, even Gaul knew not to be caught like that, in the grip of someone who could change the very capacity of one's mind. Perrin had to keep thinking of them as idiots to maintain the transformation. He knelt, seeking among the wolves for the wounded he could help. He imagined bindings on the wounds of those who were hurt. They would heal quickly in this place. Wolves seemed to be able to do that. They had lost 8 of their members, for whom Perrin howled. The others joined him, but there was no regret to their sendings. They had fought. That was what they had come to do. After that, Perrin saw to the fallen red bales. All were dead. Gaul limped up beside him, holding a burned arm. The wound was bad, but not immediately life-threatening.
"We need to take you out of here," Perrin said to him, "and get you some healing. I'm not certain what time it is, but I think we should go to Marilor and wait for the gateway out."
Gaul gave him a toothy grin.
"I killed 2 of those myself, Perrin Ebarra. One could channel. I think myself great with honor. Then you slide in and take 2 captive."
He shook his head.
"Vane would laugh herself all the way back to the Threefold Land if she saw this."
Perrin turned to his 2 captives. Killing them here seemed heartlessly cruel, but to release them meant fighting them again, perhaps losing more wolves, more friends.
"I do not suspect these keep to Jiato," Gaul said. "Would you take a man who could channel as Gaishine anyway?"
He shuddered visibly.
"Just kill them and be done with it," Lanfear said.
Perrin eyed her. He didn't jump as she spoke. He had grown somewhat accustomed to the way she popped in and out. He did find it annoying, however.
"If I kill them here, will that kill them forever?"
"No," she said. "It doesn't work that way for men."
Did he trust her? On this point, for some reason, he found that he did. Why would she lie? Still, killing unarmed men. They were barely more than babies here to him.
"No," he thought, considering the dead wolves. "Not babies. Far more dangerous than that." "Those 2 have been turned," she said, folding her arms, nodding to the 2 channelers. "Many are born to their life these days, but those 2 have the filed teeth. They were taken and turned."
Gaul muttered something. It sounded like an oath, but it also sounded reverent. It was in the old tongue, and Perrin didn't catch its meaning. After that, however, Gaul raised a spear. He smelled regretful.
"You spat in his eye, and so he uses you, my brothers. Horrible." "Turned," Perrin thought.
"Like those men at the Black Tower." He frowned, walking up and taking the head of one of the men in his hands. Could he will the man back to the light? If he could be forced to be evil, could he be restored? Perrin hit something vast as he pushed against the minds of these men. His will bounced free, like a twig used to try beating down an iron gate. Perrin stumbled back. He looked at Gaul and shook his head.
"I can do nothing for them."
"I will do it," Gaul said. "They are brothers."
Perrin nodded, reluctant, as Gaul slit the throats of the 2 men. It was better this way. Still, it ripped Perrin up inside to see it. He hated what fighting did to people, what it did to him. The Perrin of months ago could never have stood and watched this. Light, if Gaul hadn't done it, he would have himself. He knew it.
"You can be such a child," Lanfear said, arms still folded beneath her breasts as she watched him.
She sighed, then took him by the arm. A wave of icy healing washed through him. The wound on his cheek closed. Perrin took a deep breath, then nodded toward Gaul.
"I am not your errand woman, Wolfpup," she said.
"You want to convince me that you're not a foe?" he asked. "That's a good place to start."
She sighed, then waved impatiently for Gaul to approach. He did so limping, and she healed him. A distant rumbling shook the cavern behind them. She looked at it and narrowed her eyes.
"I cannot stay here," she said.
Then she was gone.
"I do not know what to make of that one," Gaul said, rubbing his arm where the clothing was burned, but the skin healed. "I believe she is gaming with us, Perrin Ebarra. I do not know which game."
Perrin grunted in agreement.
"This Slayer, he will return." "I'm thinking of a way to do something about that," Perrin said, reaching to his waist where he'd tied the dream spike to his belt with straps. He freed it. "Watch here," he told Gaul, then entered the cavern.
Perrin walked past those stones like teeth. It was hard to escape the feeling that he was crawling into the mouth of a dark hound. The light at the bottom of the descent was blinding, but Perrin created a bubble around himself that was shaded, like glass that was only translucent. He could make out Rand and someone else striking at one another with swords at the lip of a deep pit. No, it wasn't a pit. Perrin gaped. The entire world seemed to end here, the cavern opening into a vast nothingness. An eternal expanse, like the blackness of the waves, only this one seemed to be pulling him into it. Him and everything else. He'd grown accustomed to the storm raging outside, so he hadn't noticed the wind in the tunnel. Now that he paid attention, he could feel it streaming through the cavern into that hole. Looking into that gap, he knew that he'd never understood blackness before. Not really. This was blackness. This was nothingness. The absolute end of all. Other darkness was frightening because of what it might hide. This darkness was different. If this engulfed you, you would cease completely. Perrin stumbled back, though the wind blowing down the tunnel wasn't strong. Just steady, like a stream running into nowhere. Perrin gripped the dream spike, then forced himself to turn away from Rand. Someone knelt on the floor nearby, her head bowed, braced as if against some great force coming from the nothingness. Moraine? Yes. And that was Nynaeve, kneeling to her right. The veil between worlds was very thin here. If he could see Nynaeve and Moraine, perhaps they could see or hear him. He stepped up to Nynaeve.
"Nynaeve, can you hear me?"
She blinked, turning her head. Yes, she could hear him. But she could not see him, it seemed. She searched about, confused as she clung to the stone teeth of the floor as if for life itself.
"Nynaeve!"
Perrin yelled.
"Perrin?"
she whispered, looking about.
"Where are you?"
"I'm going to do something, Nynaeve," he said. "I will make it impossible to create gateways into this place. If you want to travel to or from this area, you'll need to create your gateway out in front of the cavern. All right?"
She nodded, still looking about for him. Apparently, though the real world reflected in the wolf dream, it didn't work the other way around. Perrin rammed the dream spike into the ground, then activated it as Lanfear had shown him, creating the bubble of purple just around the cavern itself. He hurried back into the tunnel, emerging through a wall of purple glass to rejoin Gaul and the wolves.
"Light," Gaul said. "I was about to go search for you. Why did it take so long?"
"So long?"
Perrin asked.
"You were gone at least 2 hours."
Perrin shook his head.
"It's the boar playing with our sense of time. Well, at least with that dream spike in place, Slayer will have trouble reaching Rand."
After having Slayer use the dream spike against him, it was satisfying to turn the Tiron Greal against the man. Perrin had made the protective bubble just large enough to fit inside the cavern and shelter Rand, the boar, and those with him. The placement meant all of the borders of the dome, save the one here at the front, were inside rock. Slayer would not be able to jump into the middle of the cavern and strike. He would have to enter through the front. Either that, or find a way to burrow through the rock, which Perrin supposed was possible here in the wolf dream. However, it would slow him, and that was what Rand needed.
"I need you to protect this place," Perrin sent to the gathered wolves, many of whom were still licking their wounds. "Shadow Killer fights inside, hunting the most dangerous prey this world has known. We must not let Slayer reach him."
"We will guard this place, young bull," one sent. "Others gather. He will not pass us."
"Can you do this?"
Perrin sent an image of wolves spaced through the borderlands, relaying messages quickly between themselves. There were thousands upon thousands of them roaming the area. Perrin was proud of his sending. He didn't send it as words or as images, but as a concept mixed with sense, with a hint of instinct. With the wolves positioned as he sent, they could send to him through the network almost instantly if Slayer returned.
"We can do it," the wolves sent.
Perrin nodded, then waved to Gaul.
"We are not staying?" he asked. "There is too much happening," Perrin said. "Time moves too slowly here. I don't want the war to pass us by."
Besides, there was still the matter of whatever Grendel was doing.
Chapter 26 Considerations. "I don't like fighting beside those Shan Chan," Gawain said softly, coming up beside Egwene. She didn't like it either, and she knew he would be able to sense that from her. What could she say? She couldn't turn the Shan Chan away. The Shadow had brought the Sharans to fight under its banner. Egwene, therefore, would have to use what she had. Anything she had. Her neck itched as she crossed the field to the meeting place about a mile or so east of the ford in Arafel. Bryn had already arrayed most of her forces at the ford. Aes Sedai could be seen atop the hills just south of the ford, and large squadrons of archers and pikemen were positioned below them on the slopes. The troops were feeling fresher. The days Egwene's force had spent retreating had relieved some of the pressure of warfare, despite attempts by the enemy to make them commit to combat. Egwene's chances depended on the Shan Chan joining the battle and engaging the Sharan channelers. Her stomach twisted. She'd once heard that in Camelin, unscrupulous men would throw starving dogs into a pit together and bet on which one would survive the ensuing fight. This felt the same to her. The Shan Chan Damani were not free women. They could not choose to fight. From what she'd seen of the Sharan male channelers, they were little more than animals themselves. Egwene should be fighting the Shan Chan with every breath, not allying with them. Her instincts rebelled as she approached the gathering of Shan Chan. The Shan Chan leader demanded this audience with Egwene. The light send it would be quick. Egwene had received reports on this Fortuona, so she knew what to expect. The diminutive Shan Chan Empress stood atop a small platform, watching the battle preparations. She wore a glittering dress, whose train extended a ridiculous distance behind her, carried by 8 Dakovail, those servants in the horribly immodest clothing. Various members of the Blood stood in groups, waiting with careful poses. Death Watch guards, hulking in their near-black armor, stood like boulders around the Empress. Egwene approached, guarded by her own soldiers and much of the hall of the tower. Fortuona had first tried to insist that Egwene come to visit her in her camp. Egwene had, of course, refused. It had taken hours to reach an agreement. Both would come to this location in Arafel, and both would stand rather than sit, so that neither could give the impression of being above the other. Still, Egwene was irritated to find the woman waiting. She'd wanted to time this meeting so they both arrived at the same moment. Fortuona turned from the battle preparations and looked at Egwene. It appeared that many of Suan's reports were false. True, Fortuona did look something like a child, with that slight build and delicate features. Those similarities were minor. No child had ever had eyes so discerning, so calculating. Egwene revised her expectations. She'd imagined Fortuona as a spoiled adolescent, the product of a coddled lifetime. "I have considered," Fortuona said, "whether it would be appropriate to speak to you in person with my own voice." Nearby, several of the Seanchan blood, with their painted fingernails and partially shaved heads, gasped. Egwene ignored them. They stood near several pairs of Suldam and Damani. If she let those pairs draw her attention, her temper might get the better of her. "I have considered myself," Egwene said, "whether it would be appropriate to speak to one such as yourself, who has committed such terrible atrocities."
"I have decided that I will speak to you," Fortuona continued, ignoring Egwene's remark. "I think that for the time, it would be better if I see you not as Marath Damani, but as a queen among the people of this land."
"No," Egwene said. "You will see me for what I am, woman. I demand it." Fortuona pursed her lips.
"Very well," she finally said. "I have spoken to Damani before. Training them has been a hobby of mine. To see you as such does not violate protocol, as the Empress may speak with her pet hounds."
"Then I will speak with you directly as well," Egwene said, keeping her face impassive. "For the Amyrlin judges many trials. She must be able to speak to murderers and rapists in order to pass sentence upon them. I think you would be at home in their company, though I suspect they would find you nauseating."
"I can see that this will be an uneasy alliance."
"You expected otherwise?" Egwene asked. "You hold my sisters captive. What you have done to them is worse than murder. You have tortured them, broken their wills. I wish to the light you had simply killed them instead."
"I would not expect you to understand what needs to be done," Fortuona said, looking back toward the battlefield. "You are Marath Damani. It is natural for you to seek your own good, as you see it."
"Natural indeed," Egwene said softly. "This is why I insist that you see me as I am, for I represent the ultimate proof that your society and empire are built upon falsehoods. Here I stand, a woman you insist should be collared for the common good, and yet I display none of the wild or dangerous tendencies that you claim I should have. So long as I am free from your collars, I prove to every man and woman who draws breath that you are a liar." The other Seanchan murmured. Fortuona herself maintained a cool face.
"You would be much happier with us," Fortuona said.
"Oh, would I?" Egwene said.
"Yes. You speak of hating the collar, but if you were to wear it and see, you would find it a more peaceful life. We do not torture our Damani. We care for them and allow them to live lives of privilege."
"You don't know, do you?" Egwene asked.
"I am the Empress," Fortuona said. "My domination extends across seas, and the realms of my protection encompass all that humankind knows and thinks. If there are things I do not know, they are known by those in my empire, for I am the empire."
"Delightful," Egwene said. "And does your empire realize that I wore one of your collars? That I was once trained by your Suldam?" Fortuona stiffened, then rewarded Egwene with a look of shock, although she covered it immediately.
I was in Falma, Egwene said. A Damani, trained by Rena. Yes, I wore your collar, woman. I found no peace there. I found pain, humiliation, and terror. Why did I not know of this? Fortuona asked loudly, turning. Why did you not tell me? Egwene glanced at the collected Shan Chan nobility. Fortuona seemed to be addressing one man in particular, a man in rich black and golden clothing, trimmed with white lace. He had an eye patch over one eye, black to match, and the fingernails on both hands were lacquered to a dark. Matt? Egwene sputtered. He gave a kind of half-wave, looking embarrassed. Oh, light, she thought. What has he thrown himself into? She galloped through plans in her mind. Matt was imitating a Shan Chan nobleman. They must not know who he really was. Could she trade something to save him? Approach, Fortuona said. This man is not, Egwene began, but Fortuona spoke over her. Not I, she said. Did you know that this woman was an escaped Damani? You knew her as a child, I believe. You know who he is? Egwene asked. Of course I do, Fortuona said. He is named Notai, but once was called Matrim Kofon. Do not think he will serve you, Marath Damani, though you did grow up together. He is the Prince of the Ravens now, a position he earned by his marriage to me. He serves the Shan Chan, the Crystal Throne, and the Empress. May she live forever, Matt noted. Hello, Egwene. Glad to hear you escaped those Sharans. How's the White Tower? Still white, I guess. Egwene looked from Matt to the Shan Chan Empress, then back at him again. Finally, unable to do anything else, she burst out laughing. You married Matrim Kofon? The omens predicted it, Fortuona said. You let yourself draw too close to a Taviran, Egwene said. And so the pattern bound you to him. Foolish superstitions, Fortuona said. Egwene glanced at Matt. Being Taviran never did get me much, Matt said sourly. I suppose I should be grateful the pattern didn't haul me by my boots over to Sheol Ghul. Small blessing, that. You didn't answer my question, Notai, Fortuona said. Did you know this woman was an escaped Damani? If so, why didn't you speak of it to me? I didn't think too much about it, Matt said. She wasn't one for very long, Tuon. We will speak of this on another occasion, Fortuona said softly. It will not be pleasant. She turned back to Egwene. To converse with a former Damani is not the same as speaking to one recently captured or one who has always been free. News of this event will spread. You have caused me inconvenience. Egwene regarded the woman, baffled. Light. These people were completely insane. What was your purpose insisting upon this meeting? The Dragon Reborn says you will help our fight. Help us, then. I needed to meet you, Fortuona said. You are my opposite. I have agreed to join this peace the dragon offered, but there are conditions. Oh, Lightrand, Egwene thought. What did you promise them? She braced herself. Along with agreeing to fight, Fortuona said, I will acknowledge the sovereign borders of nations as they are currently mapped. We will force the obedience of no Marath Damani, save those who violate our borders. And those borders are? Egwene asked. As currently outlined, as I be more specific, Egwene said. Tell me with your own voice, woman. What borders? Fortuona drew her lips to a line. Obviously, she was not accustomed to being interrupted. We control Altara, Amadicia, Tarabon, and Almuth Plain. Tremalking, Egwene said. You'll release Tremalking and the other Seafolk Islands? I did not list those, because they are not of your land but the sea. They are not your concern. Besides, they were not part of the agreement with the Dragon Reborn. He did not mention it. He has a lot on his mind. Tremalking will be part of the agreement with me. I wasn't aware we were making such an agreement, Fortuona said calmly. You require our assistance. We could leave in a moment, should I order it. How would you fare against that army without our aid, which you so recently begged me to lend? Begged, Egwene thought. Do you realize what happens if we lose the last battle? The Dark One breaks the wheel, slays the Great Serpent, and all things will end. That's if we're lucky. If we aren't lucky, the Dark One will remake the world according to his own twisted vision. All people will be bound to him in an eternity of suffering, subjugation, and torment. I am aware of this, Fortuona said. You act as if this particular fight, here on this battlefield, is decisive. If my army were to be destroyed, Egwene said, our entire effort would be jeopardized. Everything could indeed hinge on what happens here. I disagree, Fortuona said. Your armies are not vital. They are populated by the children of Oathbreakers. You fight the Shadow, and for that I grant you honor. If you were to lose, I would return to Shanshan and raise up the full might of the ever-victorious army and bring it to bear against this horror. We would still win the last battle. It would be more difficult without you, and I would not waste useful lives or potential Damani, but I am confident we could stand against the Shadow on our own. She met Egwene's eyes. So cold, Egwene thought. She's bluffing, she must be. Reports from Swan's eyes and ears said that the Shanshan homeland was in chaos, a succession crisis. Perhaps Fortuona really did believe that the Empire could stand against the Shadow on its own. If so, she was wrong. You will fight alongside us, Egwene said. You made the treaty with Rand, gave him your oath, I assume. Tremalking is ours. Oh? Egwene said. And you have set up a leader there? One of the sea folk? To acknowledge your rule? Fortuona said nothing. You have the allegiance of most of the other lands you've conquered, Egwene said. For better or worse, the Altarans and Amadicians follow you. The Taraboners seem to as well. But the sea folk? I have no reports whatsoever of a single one of their kind supporting you or living peacefully beneath your thumb. Borders, the borders you just mentioned, as they exist on maps, show Tremalking as Seafolk land. It is not yours. If our treaty holds current borders as they are, you would need a ruler in Tremalking to acknowledge you. It seemed a tenuous argument to Egwene. The Shanshan were conquerors. What did they care if they had any kind of legitimacy? However, Fortuona seemed to consider Egwene's words. She frowned in thought. This is a good argument, Fortuona finally said. They have not accepted us. They are foolish to reject the peace we offer, but they have indeed done so. Very well. We will leave Tremalking, but I will add a condition to our agreement, as you have. And your condition? You will announce through your tower and through your lands, Fortuona said. Any Marath Damani who wish to come to Ebu Dar and be properly collared must be allowed to do so. You think people would want to be collared? She was insane. She had to be. Of course they would want to, Fortuona said. In Shanshan, very occasionally, one who can channel is missed in our searches. When they discover what they are, they come to us and demand to be collared, as is appropriate. You will not force anyone to stay away from us. You will let them come. I promise you, none will. Then you should have no trouble making the proclamation, Fortuona said. We will send emissaries to educate your people on the benefits of Damani. Our teachers will come peacefully, for we will hold to the treaty. I believe you will be surprised. Some will see what is right. Do what you wish, Egwene said, amused. Break no laws, and I suspect most will allow your emissaries. I cannot speak for every ruler. What of the lands you control? Tarvalan, you will allow our emissaries? If they break no laws, Egwene said, I won't silence them. I'd allow in white cloaks if they could say their piece without driving men to riot. But light, woman, you can't actually believe. She trailed off, watching Fortuona. She did believe it. So far as Egwene could tell, she did. At least she's sincere, Egwene thought. Insane. Insane, but sincere. And the Damani you now hold, Egwene said. You'll let them go if they wish to be released? None who are properly trained would wish that. This must be equal on both sides, Egwene said. What of a girl whom you discover to be able to channel? If she does not wish to be made Damani, will you let her leave your lands and join ours? That would be like letting an enraged Grom free in a city square. You said that people will see the truth, Egwene said. If your way of life is strong, your ideals true, then people will see them for what they are. If they don't, you shouldn't force them. Let any who wish to be free go free, and I'll let your people speak in Tarvalan. Light! I'll give them room and free board, and I'll see the same done in every city. Fortuona eyed Egwene. Many of our Suldam have come to this war, anticipating the chance to capture new Damani from among those who serve the Shadow. These Sharans, perhaps. You would have us let them, or your sisters of the Shadow, free? To destroy? Murder? To be tried and executed, under the light? Why not let them be put to use? Why waste their lives? What you do is an abomination, Egwene said, feeling exasperated. Not even the Black Aja deserves that. Resources should not be discarded so idly. Is that so? Egwene said. Do you realize that every one of your Suldam, your precious trainers, is herself a Marath Damani? Fortuona spun on her. Do not spread such lies. Oh? Shall we test it, Fortuona? You said you trained them yourself. You are a Suldam, I presume? Put the Adam on your neck. I dare you. If I am wrong, it will do nothing to you. If I am right, you will be subject to its power and will prove to be Marath Damani. Fortuona's eyes widened in anger. She had ignored Egwene's barbs, calling her a criminal, but this accusation seemed to dig into her, so Egwene made certain to twist the knife a little deeper. Yes, Egwene said. Let us do it, and test the real strength of your commitment. If you prove to be able to channel, will you do as you claim others should? Will you stroll up to the collar and snap it around your own neck, Fortuona? Will you obey your own laws?
I have obeyed them, Fortuona said coldly.
You are very ignorant. Perhaps it is true that Suldam can learn to channel, but this is not the same thing as being a Marath Damani, any more than a man who can become a murderer is to be considered one.
We shall see, Egwene said, once more of your people realize the lies they've been told.
I will break you myself, Fortuona said softly. Someday your people will turn you over to me. You will forget yourself, and your arrogance will lead you to our borders. I will be waiting.
I plan to live centuries, Egwene hissed. I will watch your empire crumble, Fortuona. I will watch it with joy.
She raised a finger to tap the woman on the chest, but Fortuona moved with blurring speed, her hand grabbing Egwene's by the wrist. For one so small, she certainly was quick. Egwene embraced the source by reflex. Damani nearby gasped, and the light of the One Power sprang up around them. Matt pushed between Egwene and Fortuona and shoved them apart, holding one hand at each woman's chest. Egwene wove by instinct, intending to remove his hand with a thread of air. It fell apart, of course. Blood and ashes, that's inconvenient. She had forgotten he was there.
"Let's be civil, ladies," Matt said, eyeing one of them, then the other. "Don't make me throw the pair of you over my knee."
Egwene glared at him, and Matt met her eyes. He was trying to deflect her anger to him instead of Fortuona. Egwene looked down at his hand, which was pressed against her chest uncomfortably close to her breasts. Fortuona was also looking at that hand. Matt lowered both hands, but took his sweet time at it, as if completely unconcerned. "The people of this world need you to, and they need you level-headed, you hear me? This is bigger than any of us. When you fight each other, the Dark One wins, and that is that. So stop behaving like children."
"We will have many words about this tonight, Notai," Fortuona said.
"I love words," Matt said. "There are some deliciously pretty words out there. Smile. That's always sounded like a pretty word to me, don't you think? Or perhaps the words, I promise not to kill Egwene right now for trying to touch me, the Empress, may I live forever, because we really bloody need her for the next couple of weeks or so." He eyed Fortuona pointedly. "You really married him?" Egwene said to Fortuona. "Honestly?"
"It was an unusual event," Fortuona replied.
She shook herself, then glared at Egwene.
"He is mine, and I do not intend to release him."
"You don't seem the type to release anything once you have your hands on it," Egwene said. "Matrim does not interest me at the moment. Your army does. Will you fight, or won't you?"
"I will fight," Fortuona said. "But my army is not subject to you. Have your general send us suggestions. We will consider them. But I can see you are going to have a difficult time defending the ford against the invader without a larger number of your Marath Damani. I will send you some of my Suldam and Damani to protect your army. That is all I will do for now."
She started walking back toward her people.
"Come, Notai."
"I don't know how you fell into this," Egwene said under her breath to Matt. "I don't want to know. I'll do what I can to help free you once we are done fighting."
"That's kind of you, Egwene," Matt said. "But I can handle this on my own."
He rushed off after Fortuona. That was what he always said. She'd find some way to help him. She shook her head, returning to where Gawain waited for her. Lyalwyn had declined to come, though Egwene would have expected her to enjoy seeing some of those from her homeland. We'll need to keep them at arm's length, Gawain said softly. Agreed, Egwene said. You'll still fight alongside the Seanchan, despite what they've done? So long as they keep the Sharan channelers occupied, yes. Egwene looked toward the horizon, toward Rand, and the powerful struggle he must be embroiled in. Our options are limited, Gawain, and our allies dwindling. For now, whoever is willing to kill Trollocs is a friend. That is that. The Andoran line buckled, and Trollocs ripped through, snarling beasts with stinking breath that clouded in the chill air. Elaine's halberdiers nearby scrambled as they fell over themselves to escape. The first few Trollocs ignored them, howling and leaping over them to make room for more to pour through the opening like dark blood from a gash in the flesh. Elaine tried to gather what little strength she had left. She felt as if Sidar would slip from her at any moment, but the men fighting and dying wouldn't be any stronger than she at this point. They'd all been fighting for most of the day. Somehow, finding the strength to weave, she roasted the first few Trollocs with balls of fire, tripping up the flow through the wound in the human lines. Streaks of white, arrows from Birgitta's bow, followed. Trollocs gurgled, clawing at their necks where the arrows hit. Elaine sent strike after strike from horseback, tired hands clinging to the saddle as she blinked eyes that seemed leaden. Dead Trollocs toppled, forming like a scab over the hole, blocking the others from ripping through. Reserve troops stumbled up, seizing ground and pushing the Trollocs back. Elaine breathed out, wavering. Light! She felt as if she'd been forced to run around Camelin while pulling lead weights. She could barely sit upright, let alone hold the one power. Her vision dimmed, then darkened further. Sound faded in her ears, then darkness. Sound came back first. Distant yells, clangs, a very faint horn, the howls of the Trollocs, occasional thundering from the dragons. Those aren't firing as often, she thought. Aludra had moved to a rhythm in her firing. Bashir would pull back one section of troops and let them rest. The Trollocs would pour through and the dragons would bombard them for a short time. As the Trollocs tried to crawl up and destroy the dragons, cavalry would come in and smash them at the flanks. It killed a lot of Trollocs. That was their job. Kill Trollocs. Too slow, she thought. Too slow. Elaine found herself on the ground, Birgitta's worried face hovering above her. Oh, light, Elaine mumbled. Did I fall off? We caught you in time, Birgitta muttered. You slumped into our arms. Come on. We're pulling back. Birgitta raised an eyebrow at her, waiting for the argument. It was hard to make one, lying on her back mere paces from the front lines. Sidar had fled her, and she probably couldn't take hold of it again if her life depended on it. Yes, she said. I should check on Bashir. Very wise, Birgitta said, waving for the guard to help Elaine back onto her horse. She hesitated then. You did well here, Elaine. They know how you fought. It was good for them to see. They began a hurried trip through the back lines. Those were very shallow. Most soldiers were committed to the fight. They needed to win before that second Trolloc army arrived, and that meant throwing everything they had at this force. Still, Elaine was surprised at the depleted reserves, the small number that could be spared to rotate from the front and rest. How long had it been? The clouds had enveloped the open sky that often accompanied her. That seemed a bad sign. Curse those clouds, she muttered. What time of day is it? Maybe 2 hours from sunset, Birgitta said. Light! You should have made me return to camp hours ago, Birgitta. The woman glared at her, and Elaine vaguely remembered attempts to do just that. Well, no use arguing about it now. Elaine was recovering some of her strength and forced herself to sit